This is Hurricane Season, a podcast that explores some of the biggest storms that have greatly impacted Greater Houston people and policies. Over the next 8 episodes, Andrew Schneider will tell you about some of the biggest weather events here and how they shaped what Greater Houston is today. We begin with the Great Galveston Hurricane of 1900. A word of warning, this story contains graphic details.
On a late summer's evening in August of 2017, a monster with the power of a biblical leviathan surged out of the Gulf of Mexico and began laying waste to southeast Texas.
And now up to that Category 4 strength, 130-mile-an-hour sustained winds about 30 miles from where we're standing right now. Incredible.
The beast worked its way slowly north, driving tens of thousands from their homes.
All we're trying to do is see which freeway we can get on to try to find dry land. All of our family are underwater.
Even as the wind slowed, the storm grew deadlier, dumping a seemingly endless torrent of rain.
I never thought I'd say it, but hurricanes are easier. You calculate the storm surge and you know the areas on the coast that are going to be inundated. But in rainfall, where's it going to rain 50 inches?
And bringing a city of more than 2 million people to its knees.
Harvey, as a storm, was unprecedented.
Hurricane Harvey dumped 34 trillion gallons of water, as much as the Mississippi River empties into the Gulf of Mexico in 3 months. The storm demolished the U.S. rainfall record. It inflicted $125 billion in damage, nearly as much as Hurricane Katrina. More than 100 people died. But if Harvey was unequaled for sheer volume, there were other storms that gave ample warning of just how vulnerable our region was. I'm Andrew Schneider. What lessons did Texas, and particularly Houston, learn from past storms that kept Harvey from being worse than it might have been? And were there lessons we could have learned that went unheeded? Those are the questions we hope to answer in this 8-part series as we prepare to mark the first anniversary of Harvey. We begin with what remains the deadliest natural disaster in American history, the Great Galveston Hurricane of 1900.
Hurricane Season is a project of the Houston Flood Museum in partnership with Houston Public Media and is supported by Houston Endowment. Visit HoustonFloodMuseum.org.
Galveston was a young city in 1900 and a small one compared to San Antonio and Houston, but it was growing fast. Thousands of new residents were flocking to the island, drawn by the prospect of work and wealth. At the turn of the 20th century, Galveston was one of the richest cities per capita in the nation. It was also a city on the eve of catastrophe. Galveston's Rosenberg Library is home to the world's largest collection of documents related to the Great Galveston Hurricane.
Start out with, I always do a quick check of the sound level, so if you could just say your name and your title.
Casey Edward Green, and my title is Rosenberg Scholar. Galveston was the leading seaport in Texas. We had developed a deep water port so Galveston could accept ocean-going vessels, and so we started serving ports around the world. Galveston was also a major cotton port, second behind New Orleans.
Houston posed a threat to Galveston's crown if and when the inland city finally completed its ship channel connecting Buffalo Bayou to the Gulf. That channel was decades in the making. But Galveston sat right on the Gulf. That's a strength Galveston had shared with what had been its only other major competitor on the Texas coast, Indianola. Founded along Matagorda Bay in the mid-1840s, Indianola was Galveston's chief rival for nearly 3 decades. The city stood barely above sea level. In 1875, a massive hurricane swept out of the Gulf and flattened it, killing hundreds. Indianola was still struggling to rebuild 11 years later when an even stronger hurricane struck. Within a year, the once thriving seaport was a ghost town. Galveston had caught the edges of both the Indianola hurricanes. In 1886, the editors of the Galveston Daily News warned the city could easily share Indianola's fate unless it acted soon.
The fact is that Galveston should prepare for a storm while the weather is fine. A couple hundred thousand dollars, judiciously spent, would place Galveston beyond the danger of the storm. Were the whole island swept away, the people could neither retreat to the mainland nor appeal to the mainland for assistance.
Other Galvestonians and even some state leaders also recognized the threat. Casey Edward Green says that immediately after the second Indianola hurricane, Galveston city government considered the idea of building a 10-foot seawall.
Two proposals were developed. The city fathers didn't like either of them because they really didn't know how much these were going to cost. So nothing much was done.
In fact, despite Indianola's example, there were many who still believed Galveston was untouchable. Galvestonians could read the accounts of Indianola, but in 1886, newspapers still didn't carry photographs. Green says that made it much more difficult for people even a few hundred miles from Indianola to envision the scope of the disaster.
So really all people had to go on was their imagination. But they simply had no basis of comparison.
All that contributed to a sense of complacency in Galveston. Dwayne Jones is executive director of the Galveston Historical Foundation.
There had begun to be, by 1900, already a false hope among Galvestonians that a hurricane of the magnitude that they would see in September would never hit Galveston. And so there were some buildings that just were not constructed up and raised up, and there were buildings that were constructed too close to the water.
Many of the newer buildings, particularly the homes of working-class families, weren't that well constructed.
Also remember that Galveston was not raised. It was all at or below sea level at that time.
Against that, the city fathers and ordinary Galvestonians could rely on the assurances of experts, such as Isaac Klein, chief meteorologist at the Galveston office of the U.S. Weather Bureau. In 1891, just 5 years after Indianola's destruction, Klein wrote an article for the Galveston Daily News saying hurricanes rarely struck Texas, and the idea of one posing a threat to Galveston was, quote, an absurd delusion.
It would be impossible for any cyclone to create a storm wave which could materially injure the city.
To be fair, says Casey Edward Green, the science and technology of tracking hurricanes were still in their infancy in 1900.
This was also pre-Marconi wireless,
which meant ships encountering a hurricane at sea couldn't transmit messages ahead to warn people in the storm's path.
This was also, of course, pre-satellite photography. Even today, with all of our predictive tools, electronics, etc., hurricanes are very unpredictable beasts.
As a result, the first warning anyone in Galveston had that a hurricane had entered the Gulf was a report from the Weather Bureau office in New Orleans on Friday, September 7th, just one day before the storm arrived.
It was a raging storm headed westward. But where was it going to make landfall on the Texas coast? No one knew.
There were some in Galveston who recognized the danger. Catherine Vetter Pauls was 5 years old at the time. She gave an interview to the Rosenberg Library in 1970.
My father had heard that day in town of a hurricane in the Gulf, and all scanned the sky for some sign of the approaching storm. It was a perfect late summer afternoon, the sky clear blue and cloudless. I saw a tiny cloud drifting from the southeast and asked eagerly, "Papa, is that the hurricane?"
Saturday morning, September 8th, 1900. A breeze was picking up. The streets were beginning to flood. Meteorologist Isaac Klein went down to the beach to measure the tide, and what he saw alarmed him. He quickly telegraphed the Weather Bureau's central office in Washington.
Unusually heavy swells from the southeast, intervals of 1 to 5 minutes. Overflowing low places, south portion of city, 3 to 4 blocks from the beach. Such high water with opposing winds never observed previously.
Two of a hurricane's deadliest weapons are the wind and the storm surge. Often they work together. If the waves were this big with the wind blowing against the tide, what would happen if it shifted and blew in the same direction? Klein began warning as many people as he could. Some fled the island, but as the Rosenberg Library's Casey Edward Green notes, many more stayed until it was too late.
Disasters tend to attract people, and so we had masses along the beach who were watching the destruction until they realized that the weather is becoming too intense. They thought they could ride out the storm, and unfortunately they were wrong.
The rain that began as a shower just before 9 became a torrent by noon, and block by block, the water began to swallow the city. Louise Hopkins, then age 7, lived in a boarding house her mother ran in Galveston's East End. She gave an interview to the Rosenberg Library in 1982.
Then I saw my brothers coming home. They got home. The older one was there early and the other one. And I remember seeing him wading in water this high.
Up to his chest.
And holding his arms out like this to walk, you know, against the wind and the water. And so it frightened me too.
Some fled their homes in search of sturdier buildings. Those who reached stone or brick buildings had a better chance, but many died in the attempt, swept away by the rising flood, or cut to shreds by flying slate roof shingles. Faced with that choice, many simply climbed to the upper stories of their or their neighbors' homes. Caroline Shopper Harris's family was one of many that fled to their attic. Her children and grandchildren recorded her story in 1986.
My brother and I stood on a mattress all night long with the water up to here, up to here, and holding my head up like this to get it, keep out of that water going out. And you could hear the screeching of that house going apart.
As evening came, the wind, which had been pushing back against the waves, swung around to come in behind them. The tide surged in. Again, Casey Edward Green.
The 1900 storm reached a maximum depth on the island of Thaith, I believe, in post office of 15.7 feet. Obviously, if that water is moving, the smaller structures would have a hard time standing up to it, resisting it.
The water bashed homes to pieces, drowning those inside. It demolished telephone poles, ripped up streetcar tracks. The storm surge carried along the debris, which then demolished other houses. The wreckage finally piled high enough to act as a breakwater, protecting those in the north and center of the island, but that protection came at a horrific cost.
We don't know how many thousands of people died. Best guess is 8,000 or more on the island. Various estimates placed a loss of life between 6 and 9,000 just on the island, perhaps several thousand more on the mainland.
Many of the victims were simply unrecognizable. The water had ripped away their clothing, obliterated their faces. City authorities feared the late summer heat would cause the bodies to rot, creating a breeding ground for disease that would decimate the survivors. Police and military authorities forced able-bodied men at gunpoint to dispose of the dead, as former Galveston resident Louise Hopkins recalled.
There was no identification or no prayer said or anything else. They just were put in the ground. And then there were so many of them that they couldn't find any more ground to bury them. They took them out to sea, and then they washed back in again. So then they had to be burned. It was a terrible time.
As life slowly returned to normal, Galvestonians had to decide how or whether to rebuild.
their prophets give them warning. You had better leave this place. They never thought of leaving. Hell, just look them in the face.
One that a mighty storm, oh, one that a mighty storm will water, one that a mighty storm.
I'm standing at the northeastern tip of Galveston Island. The water you're hearing rushing among the rocks is where the Gulf of Mexico meets Galveston Bay. Galveston could have very easily slipped into the same oblivion that Indianola had just two decades before. What saved it was a massive engineering achievement. First, the construction of a gigantic seawall along the edge of the island to protect it from storm surges from the Gulf of Mexico. But hand in that was the raising of the island itself, pumping in slurry from the bottom of the gulf, raising the grade of the streets, and raising the houses and buildings by several feet. The result was that in 1915, when a hurricane even stronger than the 1900 storm swept through, destruction and deaths were kept to a minimum, and the city survived to see another day. In those 15 years, Houston eclipsed Galveston as the leading seaport on the Texas Gulf Coast. Any chance Galveston had of catching up vanished when the Houston Ship Channel opened in 1914. Many reasoned that, seawall aside, an inland port was less likely than an island to flood. They were about to get a rude awakening.
I say, you got them on my knees. You done carried away my mother. Now come back after me. One that a mighty song.
Hurricane Season is produced by Andrew Schneider, Davis Land, Todd Holslander, and me, Maggie Martin. We also had help in this episode from Edel Howland, Sydney Knight, and Mark DiClaudio. Thanks also to KHOU. You can listen to this episode of Hurricane Season and subscribe by going to houstonpublicmedia.org/Harvey. On the next episode of Hurricane Season, we revisit the storm that prompted the creation of the Harris County Flood Control District.